We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Time Is Now, Soylent Green is People. My name is Kurt North and I am here today to talk about a Season 2 episode, which is the one I've been particularly looking forward to. And joining me today is Darren Mooney. Hello Darren, how are you doing today, mate?
I'm good. How are you? How are things? How's it going?
I'm doing well. We're currently, at time of recording, we're awaiting the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'm a key worker, so I'm still working. And you are in isolation at the moment, Darren, aren't you? So it's an unusual circumstance that we find ourselves in.
It is. And again, there's something very strange about recording a Millennium podcast, particularly about the second season, in the middle of all this going on as well.
Yeah.
It has that kind of eerie resonance to it.
It does. I think as we head in towards the end of the season as well, it's going to be particularly poignant as well. So we'll see how we fare with that. And there may well be some discretionary things to talk about when we get there. But yes, it's a lovely sunny day. I know that some people have been in the gardens as they can, and for those people who haven't, they've been doing their daily exercise and things that I've spoken to. But I've been making many a phone call with many colleagues who are currently furloughed, and it's actually been quite a good day in some ways. There's been some sad phone calls, some calls that I've had to make which have been not necessarily distressing, but finding out people are quite lonely and things. But in other ones where they're actually glad to hear my voice, which is great. Which must mean I've got a podcasting voice or something along those lines. But
no, I was just going to say, soothing and easy to listen to.
Soothing and easy to listen to, yeah. We are here to talk about Owls, the episode Owls, and that was aired on the 6th of March, 1998. It was directed by Thomas J. Wright and was written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong, which was where their 12th episodes have been written by them both. And it is the first part of a two-parter, so we'll be back next week as well to discuss episode 2, which was aptly named Roosters, as we'll find out during the course of this episode. But before we do that, Darren, we need to discuss something that in other podcasts we haven't been doing. Ooh. So I'm glad it's back, is the IMDb score. So bearing in mind, as we've gone through these seasons, you've been pretty hot with these ones recently, including both on the X-Cast and The Time Is Now.
I'm trying to build you up.
So I'm going to leave this one to you. What do you think the episode Owls received on IMDb?
Okay, as with usual with the Sexies of Millennium, we're expecting kind of low votes, somewhere around the 200, maybe 300 mark, I think. I suspect the number is going to be relatively high, because the people voting for it, again, are people who've actively sought it out. It's not like the X-Files where it's a cult, you know, Millennium isn't that level of cultural phenomenon where people go onto IMDb and will just sort of be rating stuff and rate it. If you want to be on IMDb rating episodes of Millennium, you are there because you want to be, which means it's probably going to be rated quite highly because it's a mythology episode. It's going to be rated less highly than the Darren Morgan episodes. So I'm going to throw a random one out there. I'm going to say 8.6.
That's quite high. You're just slightly off the mark, but it does reach an 8, and it's 8 dead.
What?
So, yeah, 8.0.
Okay. We're going to talk. 200. We're going to have words.
Okay, let's have those words. So, 8. So, the beginning and the end got an 8.2. And it got the Curse of Frank Black got 8.3. So, you know, it's in good company. But as you say, things like Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, that got an 8.6, and Luminary, which you did recently, that received an 8.1. So it's 0.1 less than Luminary. So it's in good company. But most of the season, to be fair, is around that 7.6 to 8.6 kind of mark. So obviously, apart from Single Blade of Grass. But it's in good company. But I personally would have rated it slightly higher than that. What would you personally rate this as?
This is a 10 for me. This is an easy 10. And again, I've been kind of... I joked about it when I did the Mikado, where I gave the Mikado like 9.5. I'm like, yeah, because I want my 10s to mean something. Owls and Roosters, the two-parter, but the individual episodes as well, are episodes that were kind of hugely shocking. Not shocking. Shocking sounds kind of sensationalist. But were a big deal to me when I was watching as a teenager. Because obviously I came to Millennium a bit later than I came to the X-Files. I bought the DVDs because they had those wonderful DVD collections. And I watched them kind of... You know, I watched the first season and it was pretty good. And I thought the second half of the first season was great. And then I watched the second season and was just blown away. And I remember in particular episodes like Owls and Roosters being... rather distinct from anything that I'd seen on television before that wasn't Twin Peaks. Because these are really moody, really atmospheric pieces of television. And again, obviously, you know, as we come into the finale and we talk about the two-part season finale, that's going to be something else to discuss. Because again, I think that, you know, that kind of leaps off the back of this and jumps right into the realm of the absurd, the surreal. But there's something wonderfully... atmospheric and moody about the storytelling in Owls and also in Roosters, the second part as well, which is utterly unlike anything that I had seen before from a kind of a show like this. It's a story which works primarily based on not necessarily strict plot logic, but like general mood and atmosphere and character. It has this long pervading kind of sense of dread and existential uncertainty running through it, where it's not so much a plot-driven story in terms of this happens, then this happens, then this happens, and A, B, C fit together neatly. It's willing to take time and let sequences kind of unfold and go at their own pace. And again, this is most notable, again, in Owls, where you have that wonderful sequence set to America as a Horse with No Name, which is something that is very common with what you'd see in a prestige drama these days. In fact, it's notable that, like, you know, Vince Gilligan, who is avowedly a fan of Millennium, even if he thought it was a bit dark for regular viewers, did a similar sequence in Breaking Bad, in which, you know, the lead character there is driving in a car, singing along to A Horse with No Name by himself. But the way, if you watch the way in which that scene unfolds, the pacing of it, the rhythm of it, the way in which it builds, the way in which the music stops, then continues, then goes from being something that you hear on a car stereo to something playing on the soundtrack as a car drives away. It's just incredibly rich. It's incredibly strange. And again, it's a sequence that plays not in service of a plot that is driven by things that are happening, but in favor of kind of a larger mood, atmosphere, and tone of a piece that you're watching. And it's just staggering. And I mean, even watching it now, this is a show that aired on Fox in March 1998, in the middle of Sweeps, which again, I admire the audacity of, even if it perhaps explains why Millennium only lasted 3 seasons. I still kind of adore that, like, Morgan and Wong were like, this is our Sweeps episode, baby. Because it is so strange, but so sure of itself. And those two things are very rare to see in television, particularly when united with the third factor, which is that it's brilliant. And yeah, so it's an easy 10 for me.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, let's just pick up on the Horse with No Name, and you mentioned about Prestige Sally doing it as well, because I think that a perfect example that's taken it maybe one step further is Westworld, yeah, where they've got classic music that's referred to it, but actually in their own style. I know that started very much with the automatic piano, but even like the new season in season 3, where they've got particular songs that they're using in the background and stuff, they've taken that one step further. I would agree. I mean, I think Owls and Roosters and the finale two episodes are some of my favourite episodes of television, and are completely up there with anything that the X-Files has ever done as well, if we compare it to the likes of 1937-31 or the Anasazi trilogy.
Or most pointedly, Patient X and The Red and the Black, which were airing, like, this aired, Owls aired between those two. This aired on, what, the 6th of March, I believe, whereas Patient X, I believe, aired on the 1st of March, and Red and the Black aired on the 8th of March. So this is very much, and again, you know, you have Morgan and Wong producing the second season of Millennium. And I mean, we'll talk probably in a bit more depth when we get into it, the sense that maybe they were tweaking the nose of the X-Files a little bit, or maybe they were playing with some of the same themes of the X-Files a little bit, but in their own way. So it feels very deliberate that you have Owls and Roosters, this big existential, you know, arguably what would be in the X-Files, what we would call a mythology-driven two-parter, you know, about the kind of the underlying mythology of the show or kind of the conspiracy that drives the characters, the secrets that need to be unveiled. But doing it in a way that is remarkably different from the way that the X-Files did it. And again, you and I, we've both been on the X-Cast. We both adore the X-Files. And I particularly adore the mythology episodes. The two of us, ironically enough, talked about Patient X, The Red and the Black, and I described them as my second favorite mythology episodes. So I'm in no way disparaging the X-Files when I say that. But there's also something absolutely fascinating in the way in which Morgan and Wong basically do Millennium's version of a mythology episode, but in a way that would never be mistaken for an X-Files episode, which is a very difficult thing to do, particularly when you get into, say, the third season of Millennium, where one of the criticisms is that the show maybe tried to turn itself into the X-Files light. Here you have it almost kind of in conversation with the X-Files, and it's remarkable to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll touch about this in, as well as we go in, but it's almost like a theological look rather than the propulsiveness of Patient X and Red and the Black in some ways. It even goes in that far with the concept of Owls and Roosters as well, which I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, I would not necessarily give it a 10, because as I've said in previous ones, I think I gave Doomsday Defense something like a 9.9.75. Or something.
You calculate with a spreadsheet, because that's like a weirdly specific number.
Yeah, but I'll definitely give this a 9.5. I think I think I said this in The Red and the Black when we talked about it on the X-Cast, where you're splitting up the episode and physically just watching the one episode without watching the second one, which is what I've done last night and this morning. And it gives you a different sense, because it as a fully formed episode, it actually really works. And, you know, you're just seeing what comes up next, and the way that the cliffhanger works quite well. And I'm sure we'll talk about the very end with Frank's choice and what he does there. But it works really well, and I think it's just a marvellous piece of television. And as I say, the kind of the theological aspects, the real analysis of science versus religion is interesting, without being too on the nose with it. It kind of deals with themes rather than it does directly saying one thing or the other, which I really like. So I think we should dive straight into the episode and let's have a look at it in a bit more depth. So we start in Damascus, Syria. And this is where a group of men use what I've noted to say this on the Wikipedia for the X-Files do a Millennium one, and I quite like this, because it says a group of men using sophisticated radar, which looks quite dated nowadays. But they do.
And a high ace van. Don't forget the high ace van.
Oh, you can't forget the van. But yeah, they do locate what is then what we later find out to be the crucifixion cross. And I think let's dive straight into this, being that it's the opening, because it does open very much like what you would see from an X-File episode, and the way that it's designed itself, and it's, you know, the kind of mystery box around it until we get to find out what this is. But what did you make of this opening generally, in the way that it's portraying this almost supernatural element right at the very end of the teaser?
I actually really like, well, first of all, I really like Mark Snow's kind of score. It comes a little bit close to some of the ethnic kind of cliche stuff that Snow can do on occasion, when he's kind of scoring, you know, we are in a different country, even though we're on a soundstage or in Vancouver. But there's this wonderful kind of percussive kind of bass quality that runs through it, which kind of just, the sound of drums kind of, that kind of get you going and get it kind of, set this kind of sense of there being momentum kind of driving the scene. And it works really well, because the scene works kind of in a way that is visually interesting, where you have this setting, which is quite unusual for Millennium. As you pointed out, it does look a little bit like an X-Files opening, although to be fair, even the X-Files, I don't think, would have gone for something that is quite as mystical as, you know, a mosque in Syria, isn't it?
Syria, yeah.
Syrian mosque.
Damascus,
yeah. Wouldn't have gone for something that is that kind of distinct or different. I mean, even if you look at, say, trips to Hong Kong in, Apocrypha and Piper Maru, there's a tendency to portray those spaces as kind of, you know, not Vancouver-esque, but, you know, like urban and kind of familiar and recognizable. Whereas with the music and with the kind of soundstage setting here, it immediately feels very distinct and very different from what you normally see on Millennium, what even you would see on the X-Files. But you have, again, this... And again, it's something that you can tell Morgan and Wong being kind of heavily influenced by 70s or 80s cinema. You have this sense of men on a mission wearing these kind of ski masks and they're up to something, but the episode keeps it vague as to what exactly they're doing, but you're wondering why they're doing it because it's very methodical. They have that advanced radar technology that you mentioned, but they have the little drill. They're very precise about what they're doing. Somebody catches them, you know, it's all done in silhouette. Again, Thomas Wright's direction is really, really good here. It's very atmospheric, very moody. The lighting gives you lots of long shadows and lots of characters who are almost in half silhouette because of the way the light's positioned. And you have this kind of moment where they're caught, but oh no, they're not caught. He's actually on it, but oh wait, they're actually caught, which kind of, again, gives you this sense of propulsive momentum running through it. So that you then kind of like, as this is happening, you're like, yes, but all of this is over effectively a 2x4 plank of wood. And then it hits you. Then you have the really surreal moment when the guy picks up that wood. The guns jam. He executes these two people at point blank range, gets in the high ace van and hightails it. And then he's like, oh, by the way, this is a piece of the true cross. This is the blood of Christ. And it's like, wow. You know, again, it's one of those things that is... Millennium had obviously done The Hand of Saint Sebastian earlier in the season, and it's very easy to contextualize Owls and Roosters as an episode that feels like an extension of that, but it's still absolutely, and again, we're in the late second season at this point, so it's almost pointless to say it is impossible to imagine the show that gave us Loin Like a Hunting Flame giving us something like this. But it is, if you had watched the first season of Millennium, even allowing for episodes like Marantha, for example, even allowing for oddities like Lamentation and Powers, Principalities, and Thrones and Dominions, watching that opening, getting your kind of 70s spy thriller on, and oh, by the way, this is a piece of the cross that Jesus was crucified on, and it also grants its user supernatural powers, is so so far outside the realm of what you expected from an episode of Millennium, even now, that it seems kind of strange. But at the same time, it's executed with enough skill and enough craft that you're like, okay, I'll see where this is going. And that's again remarkable. It's dizzying.
You mentioned The Hand of Saint Sebastian. I mean, it's not, and it will draw comparisons. And Glenn Morgan himself actually does say that, you know, he naturally came out from James Wong, who wrote that episode, that he felt that it was nice to be influenced by something that your partner did, and wanted to break the split in which we saw into a secular one. But which we'll talk about that in a bit of detail. But it was from what Glenn Morgan has said that, you know, the Hand of Saint Sebastian was the genesis for this, really. Let's talk about the cross then, and this idea of the Millennium Group collecting things, because that is something that has been mentioned in The Hand of Saint Sebastian, that was the coming evil in the coming Millennium, where this is like about the fact that whoever has this crucifixion will indefinitely pretty much survive any fight to the death, and Armageddon being a major play in that, and the discussion that Peter Watts has with Lara during that scene where Peter Watts explains
any battle,
all
and he's like, oh no, wait, oops, apocalypse, that's what I meant, didn't mean battle, never mind, forget I said battle, no battle, no conflict.
So as a kind of the story, as the story goes, this is the reason why we have so many different elements to this story, that the crucifixion is cross and the Hand of Saint Sebastian is really important. It's almost like a collector's item for them, as if they're going to the local store and buying Panini stickers for Premier League footballers when you're like 12-year-old and swapping them. So what did you make to this idea that you have these elements that are in scripture and in religious context are there to help with the coming Armageddon that's due to come?
Again, this is one of those things where it's almost hard to talk about without kind of stepping on the toes of what we talk about next week in Roosters. But again, one of the things that I find interesting about the way in which Millennium approaches these matters, and again, this is probably one of those points of difference between it and the X-Files, and we'll probably get into that in a bit more depth later on. But throughout Millennium, there's this ambiguity that borders on ambivalence towards the actual importance of what these things are and the role that they have and whether they actually will serve the function that people believe that they will. And again, you have that even here where the true cross, you know, nominally allows the person who holds it to survive absolutely everything and has never been defeated. You know, the army holding it has never been defeated in battle. Although paradoxically, of course, naturally, nobody has held on to the true cross forever. So obviously, they have been defeated at some point. You have it even here where, like, the Millennium Group manages to grab a hold of the true cross. You have the agent from France who basically takes it with him. But he's, you know, killed in an airport while nominally, you know, he's not physically holding it, but while it's in his presence and while it's in his custody. And you have this kind of thing where, as well throughout, you know, in the next episode where Axeman will have the true cross in his possession, but that won't save him when it actually matters. And even at the end of the episode, when the true cross is kind of returned to the Millennium Group, where does it go? It doesn't go on display in a museum. It doesn't, you know, as Laura Means jokes at the end of this episode, you know, you're not going to put it in the museum. You're not going to sell it to the Vatican. What are you going to do with it? It ends up almost as kind of a paperweight. It's tucked away at the back of a shelf. And there's a real sense of kind of, what does this actually mean? This thing that has caused all this death and destruction, that's prompted this battle, that has led to kind of all these countless deaths, all this massive amount of destruction and chaos. People have fought and died over this thing. What does it actually contribute? And again, it's notable, and again, maybe not to... I'm always curious about people who are watching along the first time listening to the podcast, or whether people have already seen the season. But again, in a modern show or in The X-Files, you would expect the piece of the True Cross to come back in a very literal, very direct sense as a MacGuffin at the end of the season. You'd expect almost, you know, somebody to be like, well, thank goodness we have the True Cross. Nudge, nudge. And I think that one thing that's interesting about Millennium is that it avoids that sort of approach to these things, where it leaves it open enough for you to interpret kind of as you see fit. And again, it kind of plays throughout where, you know, again, is the True Cross, you know, does it grant its users special powers or special protections? Or is it just, you know, something that has some power that we don't necessarily understand, but to which we ascribe purpose and reason and destiny? And that's the thing that gets at what you mentioned there with the kind of the divide between the secular and the religious within the group, where you have the owls and the roosters, and they are both... they both believe something that is close enough to the same thing. In Roosters, Peter actually compares them to Catholics and Protestants. And, you know, as somebody from Ireland, I think maybe he's being a little bit glib about the situation up in Northern Ireland. But he does legitimately have a point. Again, you have a situation where Christianity, you know, split over the nailing of a proclamation to a door, the selling of indulgences, the question of whether or not, you know, whether or not what you eat at communion is literally the body and blood of Christ or the metaphorical body and blood of Christ. And that schism has caused countless, you know, large amounts of destruction and devastation over these nominally tiny differences in what you actually believe. It's that narcissism of petty differences. And again, the show keeps coming back to that, where it's like the Millennium Group, all the members of the Millennium Group believe that the millennium will be a time of change. They believe that something's going to happen that will change mankind's understanding of the universe and the world around them. They just disagree over the nature of that or the timing of that. And yet somehow they can't reach an understanding of each other. They can't agree with themselves. They're confused, they're divided, they're working across purposes. And again, this is something that I find absolutely fascinating. Again, it's that ambiguity. I think that if this were an X-Files episode, it would be completely unambiguous that the MacGuffin in question is supernatural. You know, again, in the early seasons of the X-Files, the show occasionally did try to do some ambiguity about whether aliens actually existed. And you could argue that even the fifth season, which was running kind of parallel to the sixth season of Millennium, you had episodes like Redux 1 and Redux 2, which nominally in inverted commas suggested that maybe aliens weren't real. But by that stage, it was too far. The show had gone too far and committed too heavily for the audience to ever believe that there was going to be a rational explanation or a non-structured, you know, logical, mythology-driven kind of play-by-play bullet point summary of what was actually happening. Whereas Millennium is ambiguous throughout, and it is open to interpretation, and it does leave these questions hanging in the air. And I don't think the show has a clear kind of like concise bullet point explanation for who is right and who is wrong, what exactly is working in which particular way to cause the events that are occurring. I think the show is deliberately and pointedly ambiguous because I think that ambiguity is the point. And I think that ambiguity is what distinguishes Millennium from The X-Files when it does these big mythology episodes. And it's a reason why I absolutely adore it, because I think that that's a bold thing to do as a television show. Sorry.
Well, no, I'm sure we'll pick up on that, because you've mentioned before about how Millennium can just go absolutely batshit crazy with a lot of stuff. And I'm sure we'll get into that when we get to the Peter Watson and Frank Black's conversation. But continue on with this Owls and Roosters thing then, that the Millennium Group actually meet. We are led to believe that they are all roosters, from what being said, that the Owls are the secular kind of aspect to the Millennium Group, in that they believe that there will be an event that the science will say, like, for example, Einstein predicting there'll be black holes before actually being able to prove it, or wherever that may be, that they do believe that there will be a theological change, but they don't believe it's going to be in 2000, it'll be in 2060. So we have this element. But what I appreciate, and I think it would have been quite interesting if you go back as far as Force Majeure, that they kind of touch on that in Force Majeure, Chip Johansson's script there, that there is this element of the secular that's already been in play before. It would have been nice maybe to see a couple more bits within the series, but I appreciate that that's not the way it would have worked, full stop. But it is a good way of like creating this division and creating a room for what we will find out to be this other group, which is the Axemen, which we'll talk about in Roosters in more depth. But there is this availability of like causing this wedge between them. Oh, see what I did there?
This bit of wood.
That there is that ability to actually make them infight within themselves and to effectively have this civil war within the Millennium Group itself, and to cause these issues that will have an effect and will give an advantage to another side.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of things that are actually very, very interesting about the Owls and Roosters. The first thing is that you would assume that Owls and Roosters is just something that Glenn Morgan and James Wong came up with by themselves, that it's kind of a cool image. They're two birds and they have kind of thematically opposed perspectives. And, you know, obviously we're writing a show about the Millennium, so people are going to have thematically opposed perspectives about the Millennium. What's actually fascinating, and again, this is something that's true of a lot of Morgan and Wong's writing, both on The X-Files and here, is how much of this is actually drawn from stuff that people actually believe in, conversations that were actually happening maybe on the margins of pop culture in the mid-90s. So, for example, Richard Lanz wrote an article for the Union Seminary Quarterly Review in 1996, in which he defined kind of the argument about what the new millennium represented in terms of owls and roosters. He said, "Roosters crow about the imminent dawn, apocalyptic prophets, messianic pretenders, a chronologist calculating an imminent doomsday. Owls are night animals. They dislike both noise and light. They want to hush the roosters, insisting that it is still night, that the dawn is far away, that the roosters are not only incorrect, but dangerous. The foxes are still about, and the master asleep." This is an article written in 1996. Note that the language is actually employed fairly directly in the call that Frank receives at the start of the episode. And again, this is something, even that, which was the first reference that I could find to owls and roosters in millennial thinking, even that isn't the first example of it, because going back, I think, a couple of years to Rabbi Sinali's, and I apologize for mangling this, the Sanhedrin 98b in the Sonsino Babylonian Talmud, he argued that the divide was actually between roosters and bats. Land just changed the bats to owls because he didn't like the connotation of kind of portraying secular belief as kind of flying rodents. He thought that it was much more interesting to argue that they were wise owls and to set up that juxtaposition between them. But it's amazing how much of that kind of, all that stuff is kind of bubbling away in the background. It sounds absolutely crazy in the context of the episode, but it's weird that like Morgan and Wong have just kind of taken that stuff and applied it at face value. I mean, again, we'll probably get into it when we talk about the stuff that Peter's kind of talking about, that sequence with Peter and with Frank later on. But like, you know, the argument that there's an owl nesting in the corner of your dollar bill, for example, or the owl, which is frequently associated with Freemasonry, you know, is apparently carved into the surface of Washington, D.C. If you look at the street maps from above, apparently you can spot various owl shapes carved out in atlases of the city. Again, this kind of sense of conspiratorial thinking, which is, is something that you associate with fringe belief, but which is kind of all folded in and all incorporated so skillfully. And again, this is one of those things that I think Millennium does better than the X-Files. And you mentioned there this idea of a schism or a wedge, that block of wood, as you mentioned, between the two groups. And I think this is kind of... The X-Files kind of tries to do it around this point. And I suspect if we're... I think I talked about this with Tony on Gethsemane. I think the reason why the X-Files tries to do it is because of things like Timothy McVeigh, for example. And this kind of like the emergence of conspiratorial thinking in a way that isn't necessarily healthy to public discourse. So it tries to be more skeptical about it. So you have episodes of the X-Files that are like, well, maybe there are rival conspiracies at work, which are like obviously Tunguska and Terma, for example. But you also have episodes like The Red and the Black and Patient X, which are like, well, what if the entities organizing the conspiracy, so the conspirators and also the colonists, what if they're not monolithic entities, and what if they are both at civil war? And again, it's notable that Owls and Roosters aired opposite Patient X and The Red and the Black, which is also an episode about how divided the mythology is on the X-Files, how sort of, you know, they aren't one cohesive entity moving with a clear purpose. But what I think Millennium has to its advantage, and when I say this knowing full well that it's also probably a reason why a lot of people don't like it very much or kind of have objections to it, is that Millennium understands, and I think the X-Files understands as well, but the X-Files kind of also understands that if you're going to please audiences, you need to have a clear, coherent narrative with a strong beginning, middle, and end, and a strong drive running through it. But that at the turn of the millennium, people were turning towards conspiracy theory and they were looking for organizing principles, the secret code of the universe. They were looking for those owl shapes, you know, in the Washington, D.C. kind of geography. They were looking for the owls nesting in the corner of the dollar bill. And the reason why people were doing that was because, you know, you wanted to feel like you were in control. You wanted to feel like somebody somewhere was in control of the world. Like there was some plan, even if it was a plan that you didn't know about, even if it was a plan that was hidden, even if it was a plan that was sinister, at least there would be a purpose and a reason to what's happening. And again, you can see that with the X-Files, with the mythology, where there is an ordering principle to the universe. There is an answer to all of the questions that Mulder asks. There is something that accounts for the loss of Samantha and the breakup of Mulder's family. There is something that accounts for, you know, why the government has betrayed the American people so many times for so long. And that answer is... there are aliens. And it's, you know, I mean, the show complicates it as it goes on. It gets a bit more nuanced here and there. But broadly speaking, it's a very clear line. There's a sense of somebody is running the world and therefore everything is under control. Even if those people are horrible, at least we know that there is an intelligence driving it. What Millennium does, which I think is fascinating, brilliant, much more. And again, I love the X-Files. I don't want this to sound like I'm disparaging it, but much more interesting and perhaps much more provocative than the X-Files is that it takes that conspiracy, that belief in conspiracy, that belief in an ordering principle, and basically says, no, it escalates it to a point where it becomes almost absurd. Where watching the second season of Millennium, there isn't a single overarching conspiracy that accounts for everything. There are dozens of overarching sinister conspiracies that account for their own worldviews. And they're all operating across purposes from one another. None of them actually account or explain for anything. Again, it's one of those bizarre situations like those polls that suggest if you believe one conspiracy theory, you are statistically far more likely to believe even more conspiracy theories. Even the ones that directly contradict the other ones that you believe, which is kind of one of those great examples of how conspiratorial thinking works. And watching the second season of Millennium, you have that sense of not only is the Millennium group a secret cabal of people trying to control the course of human history and set human destiny and possibly guide us towards the new millennium. They're also operating in a world where there are other conspiracies at play, possibly including the X-Files conspiracy. But in this particular episode here, a conspiracy involving, you know, Odessa, which we'll talk about next week when we get into Owls and Roosters. But even later on in the season, groups like the Trust. Like, there is no one sinister organization with a clearly articulated plan that will guide mankind towards the future and explain absolutely everything that's happening in the world. There are countless competing different plans where nobody can control anything and nobody has any idea what's actually happening. And again, this is one of the things where, you know, people ask, you know, am I a conspiratorial thinker, or are you a conspiratorial thinker, or do you believe in kind of conspiracy theory? And, you know, people believe what they believe, and people kind of obviously have reasons for believing what they believe. My big issue with buying into conspiracy theories, and it doesn't matter what the conspiracy theory is, it could be anything from the death of Kennedy, which again, referenced in this exact episode later on, when they study Johnson's body. But like, the reason why I can't believe in that sort of conspiracy theory is because I don't believe that human beings are capable of organizing. That's it, exactly. Yeah. Like, nobody can keep a secret. The only way three people can keep a secret is if two of them are dead. And that's kind of like, I think that the second season of Millennium believes that and decides to tell a conspiracy thriller anyway. And the results are utterly unlike anything I had seen before or have seen since. And sorry, that's a very broad, rambling answer to your question about Owls and Roosters. But I think that kind of gets at it, which is like, even within the Millennium Group, which is nominally about guiding mankind towards the future and kind of like ensuring that mankind survives the big change at the millennium, even within that group, which has a very narrow focus, very specific goal, and like a very tight structure of people who come from a common background, most of them being former FBI agents, they can't decide themselves what the future looks like. And I think that's brilliant. I think that's clever. I think that's amazing. And I think actually pulling it off in the course of the second season is astounding. I love this show so much. Sorry, this is turned into a weird rave.
Hey, no, it's fine. I mean, we can talk about conspiracy theories all day. With you mentioned about the conspiracy theory of not people being able to, you know, to hold a secret and two people having to be dead if you're out of the three, which is absolutely right. You see that all the time in a lot of things, that the world is full of chaos, and the fact that, you know, it just goes to show you that in the X-Files, often they bumble their way through things and things just happen because it's not physically possible. You're going to have your deep throat characters like you would do in the Nixon era and whatever, and you're going to have these things where, you know, you can't keep a secret. You know, a cabal of you know, that whole Watergate issue is a perfect example of how things can fall apart. But and I think that you're right with the this idea of the way that Millennium deals with things. It almost like an entropy of such that, you know, we're heading towards something that is chaos, that is the end of the world. That, you know, it's not structured in any way. That you've got these strengths that, and these issues that are coming, and that you mentioned the Trust, which will be later on, and Odessa, which we'll talk about next week. But this idea that as you approach the end, that the, you know, these chasms are starting to create and to tear off, and people start, you know, and in some ways fear what's coming, you know, or fear for themselves. They'll become very kind of insular in themselves and actually be able to, you know, they're holding on from a personal point of view what they actually physically believe. We will pick up just on in a few minutes just on the conversation. But just before we delve into that, one of the things that I find really interesting is the arc of Lara, which comes in. She's only in a few episodes over the course of the season, but this is quite an important one for her, and it's almost like a coming together of what we've seen in the past. The fact that she has these visions of the fear of what's coming, and she sees them in the corner. But in this one, she's questioning herself, and it's an owl that comes to her to try and prey on her. Do you think that was seeded enough for you? And what did you think to Lara's little conundrum here, that she's looking at the research in psychological effects and hallucinations, as opposed to what we've seen in, say, for example, you were seeing over the Christmas, no, even like the Christmas period, you know, so we've got like The Curse of Frank Black and Midnight of the Century, which Frank has gone through. You mentioned Monster, which is where we've kind of come and see her from. But this is kind of her experience of like questioning that, isn't it? Whereas in the past with Frank Black in the two episodes, which is obviously he's our main protagonist, but then we're seeing what she's having to deal with and the fact that she's questioning herself at this point.
And again, you have that sense of kind of division and that sense of people being divided. And I mean, it's notable over the course of this episode that, you know, Frank is divided in several senses. And I mean, over the course of the season, you have this idea of kind of Laura Means almost serving as a mirror to Catherine. I mean, later on in the season, they actually work a case together to underscore it. But even in terms of Frank's life, you have this idea of kind of Laura serving as a kind of a doppelganger or replacement for Catherine in terms of being, you know, his work partner, being the partner with whom he works, and the question about whether or not he shares a greater bond with her, given that she shares kind of similar perceptual issues that, you know, that he has in terms of she sees angels, whereas he has visions, and whether or not he can relate to her in a way that he can't necessarily relate to Catherine, and kind of how those kind of cross into one another. But even here, where you have the divide between Laura and Frank, where up until this point, the two of them have largely worked together. They've been partners. They're assigned to work cases together. They have an understanding of one another. They have a genuine friendship. When you get to like Midnight of the Century, for example, like they're genuinely warm to one another. But what happens here is you have them divided. You have Frank, who's cast out of the group, or cast himself out of the group, at least temporarily. And you have Laura, who is beckoned into the group and then cast out from the group. And again, you have this idea of the two of them being divided from one another. But you're entirely right when you kind of parallel what's happening with them. And again, this is one of the things that I really like about the second season of Millennium. And again, I feel like I am a cheerleader for the second season of Millennium. It's one of my favorite seasons of television ever. But it's like you have this idea running through the season of almost a kind of a psychological break from reality. And you have this sense of paranoia. And again, this is something that is a very X-Files theme. Like, again, the wonderful Chris Knowles has noted kind of in his criticism of the X-Files that what tends to happen in the X-Files is that, you know, almost like clockwork before the season finale, you will have an episode about the characters experiencing a break from reality. So think of like, you know, in the second season, Mulder has his Anasazi break from reality in the finale. But in the third season, you have Wetwired before Talitha Kumi. In the fourth season, you have Demons before you have Gethsemane. In the fifth season, you have Folie à Deux before you have The End. In the sixth season, you have Field Trip before you have, obviously, Biogenesis. And so you have this idea that in the X-Files as well, that this nervous breakdown kind of theme is perhaps related to the conspiracy mythology in the sense that, you know, maybe the skin is cracked on the surface of the world. But like on the X-Files, you always have this kind of sense of like there being a world that exists underneath it all that makes sense of it. Like there's never a worry in the X-Files that Mulder's actually having a psychotic breakdown and aliens don't exist. And again, this is something that I really like about Millennium. I think is really ambitious and really weird, is that as you're watching it, it feels much more subjective than the X-Files does in that sense, in that like you could honestly believe that Frank is having a nervous breakdown or that Laura is having a nervous breakdown. And it's notable that she's reading that book. And again, it's about the psychological effects of hallucinations. She's trying to parse what is happening to her in a very subjective sense. She's trying to make sense of kind of her experience of what's happening. And again, you have that with Frank as well throughout the course of the episode where, you know, early on, that conversation he has with Peter is very similar. It's very similar to a conversation that he has with Catherine at the start of Roosters. But even without that context, it's very clear that it's very similar to a conversation that he would have had with Catherine, that he would have had about his ex-wife. And so you have this idea of the second season of Millennium, although it's technically about the end of the world in this kind of big mythological sense involving artifacts like the True Cross and battles involving like Nazis versus Freemasons, you also have a sense that the end of the world is this very personal, very intimate, very subjective thing where your sense of reality begins to erode. And again, it's that genuine paranoia, that most existential paranoia, where you're not even sure that they're out to get you. You're just sure that something is out to get you, and it may be your own fear that they're out to get you. And you can't trust that. And again, that's something that feels very timely in terms of, you know, as we're rushing towards the millennium, you know, and arguably even now, it feels even more timely in this era of social media and when you're reading the internet. And again, that wonderful Kurt Anderson article, I think he wrote for The Atlantic, but expanded into a book about how America lost its mind. But the sense that, like, as America connected to the internet, as all this information became available, it all just flooding towards you. And you, as somebody who was used to receiving information in a very narrow kind of way, in a person talking one-on-one, or maybe listening to a radio or watching a television with three channels on it, all of a sudden have to learn how to parse all of that information just pouring at you through a fire hose nonstop 24/7, and not being sure what exactly constitutes reality and what exactly constitutes, you know, just your reaction to the sheer volume of information that you're receiving. And I think that that's something that Laura Means does very well, where it's like, is she having these experiences of doomsday? Is she having actual visions that are being guided by a spiritual force? Or is she actually just going over the edge and having a psychotic break? And again, I think a lesser show would pick one very clear answer to that question. And I think that Millennium, its key strength is that up until the end, it doesn't really. Even when you get to where Laura Means is in the finale, which again is one of my favorite sequences of television ever, what's actually happening is highly debatable, to the point where even I am not entirely sure whether what's happening to Laura is her processing what's happening to the world, her receiving some information from some source, some Lovecraftian horror that she can't process, and trying to parse that in a way that makes sense to her, or whether it actually does mean that God is speaking to her and telling her what is happening, how it is happening, and why it is happening. And again, I kind of think that there's something very gutsy in a television show leaving that much open to interpretation, because the questions are as important as the answers.
And if that's not a teaser for the Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now, I don't know what is. So people stay tuned for us at the end of the season when we'll delve into that in much further detail. I'm sure we will. With regards to Lara then, so she you mentioned that she gets brought into the group and then kicked out by Peter because she's seen that Peter sees that she's been coerced by the owls, and even then it's kind of like a knee-jerk reaction, really. But let's move on from that. Let's talk about what will become more of a focus in the next episode, but it's been coming for a while, especially in the likes of Luminary. We've got, you know, Catherine kind of coming back into the fore here, and then we've got the family unit starting to pull together, and even to the point where Frank is saying, oh, I'd like to have her over, and it felt like family there. What do you make up to this point now with that we are coming to effectively like almost like the calm before the storm in some ways, that it's focusing itself on that and where Catherine is in relation to Millennium as we speak right now. And then obviously we'll talk about more about this in Roosters next week.
And again, this is one of those things where, again, the point of comparison is almost the X-Files. I feel really bad that we're on a Millennium podcast. I'm just like, yeah, but look what the X-Files is doing so much. And again, this is something that, again, I think is just different. But I think it's worth doing. And I think what Millennium does is messier and more ambitious. But what you have, like, in the X-Files and in Millennium is this idea of the metaphor of what's happening outside the family home reflecting what's happening inside the family home. And again, in The X-Files, you could argue that like the primary narrative arc there is Mulder making peace with his father, whether that father is Bill Mulder or later on the cigarette-smoking man, and coming to terms with that. And I think what the big difference between the second season of Millennium and The X-Files is the way in which that outside conflict, that sense of, well, the entire world being ordered around this chaos and this anger and this separation, is very much kind of subservient to the familial metaphor as opposed to the other way around. So on The X-Files, you know, Mulder's relationship with his father and the gap that exists between them serves as a broader commentary in American society about the gulf that exists between, you know, baby boomer parents and their children, and kind of the sense of, this isn't the world that you promised you'd leave me. What have you done with that? And it's a conversation that happens at a broad social level. You know, and you could see it around the same time unfolding in movies like Forrest Gump, for example. And it's just a way of literalizing that kind of social metaphor. Millennium works in almost the exact opposite way, where the heart of the second season is the breakdown of the Black family unit. It's the divide between Frank and Catherine. And everything else that happens outside is just almost a metaphor for that family breakdown. It's almost filtered through that prism to the point where, like, all the stuff that happens to Frank over the course of Owls and Roosters, and a lot of insane stuff happens to Frank over the course of Owls and Roosters, is very much kind of anchored in this question of how he feels about the separation from his family, that relationship that he has with Catherine, and that desire to kind of, like, maybe build this family unit back together again. And again, you have this situation, and we're going to talk about Odessa next week, but the situation that happens with AirTech, where you have, you know, Clear Knight, great name, by the way, but you have Clear Knight basically saying, you know, we want you to be part of our family. And you have Peter Watts, who's talking about, you left your family, but you didn't leave us. And you have this idea of kind of like everything outside the Black household is arguably just a larger extension of this familial dysfunction, this breakdown of a marriage, this separation of two people who love each other very, very much. And again, that's one of the reasons why, you know, as much as Catherine doesn't always get a lot to do in the second season, although I do think they try as they go on and they find some interesting uses for her. Megan Gallagher is always great. But I do think that she is very important, and I do think that she serves a very important function. I think that Frank's journey with her feels very real and very emotional, and something the show is very heavily invested in. And so, yeah, I think that, like, it's vitally important that you have this happening now. And again, there's that contrast that you have where, like, the Millennium group is going through what is effectively a divorce between the Owls and Roosters. And in fact, it's often kind of framed as such. I mean, there's a sequence in Roosters that's almost like a family adjudication. It's like a sequence from Marriage Story when they go into an office and, you know, Philip Baker Hall sits down. He's like, well, before I read this sealed document, I want you to talk about your feelings, which is, again, it's very much kind of a marriage counseling scene for the entire Millennium group. And it happens throughout as well. And that sequence where, you know, Peter rejects. You mentioned that sequence where Peter kicks Laura out of the group. That's a cheating sequence. That's a sequence of somebody finding a note in a diary or a piece of jewelry or something from a lover where it shouldn't be, and reacting immediately and emotionally without any sense of logic or reason or trying to parse what's happened, and just having an instinctive reaction of, get out of here. I can't trust you. We can't be family anymore because of what I've found. It doesn't matter that there's no substance to the accusation. It doesn't matter that, you know, there's no proof. It doesn't matter that there's, you know, no sense of what actually happened. All that matters is he found her name where it shouldn't have been. And he had an immediate emotional response that was equivalent to a familial betrayal. And so that relationship is broken down and gone. And again, I kind of like that everything in Millennium builds, or everything in the second season of Millennium at least, builds outwards from Frank and Catherine, in that everything that happens makes sense when you contextualize it by reference to what's happening with Frank and Catherine. I think that's kind of interesting. And again, I think it's unusual in a show like this, because again, you know, you assume it's going to be mythology driven, and it is mythology driven. There's a lot of mythology in these episodes, but all of it boils down to this idea of a family breaking up, whether that family is the Millennium group or that family is the Blacks.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll get more into this with the conversation that Frank and Catherine have, because there is a coming together there. But this is the beginning of that, isn't it? Because it starts with, as I say, you know, we've had the breakup in the beginning of the season, and we get into this point now where Owls is kind of just referencing the point that there is almost like a bridge being built between the two of them, that the tether is very weak, but there is something there that they can build towards. And then, you know, we kind of get this as we head into Roosters, and we'll talk about that in a bit more detail, that you do have that kind of aspect come in, because it's, you know, it's been touched upon, like Luminary, for example, is something where we're slowly getting there, that you know, the Catherine, I think, was it Lumine, was where Catherine goes to see Peter, doesn't she?
And it's almost two lovers fighting over somebody else. It's like, it is basically Frank's two families fighting over him. That's exactly what that scene is.
Yeah, so we're getting to this almost like mending element to it, and you know where we go from there, we'll find out as we progress through the season. But we do have the scene between Peter. I know we've touched on it a couple of times, but the scene, which is one of my favourite scenes of the season as a whole, when Peter and Frank have their debate. Just from a directional point of view, I really love the scene where Frank actually points at Peter and steps backwards. I think it's an amazing piece of little, just a tiny little thing where he's having a go, but it's totally within Frank, because Frank isn't someone who will actively get in someone's face, because he's very much more of a methodical person. He's stepping back when he makes that argument, which I particularly like from a directional point of view. But we do have some little nods to what we've mentioned before about X-Files and things within this little comments that Peter makes. But the actual conversation, dive into that for us. What do you make of that? And is it one of your favourite moments of the season as well?
It's a fantastic sequence. And again, that's what happens when you have people like Terry O'Quinn and Lance Henriksen bouncing off one another and getting passionate and angry. And again, this is, you know, I mentioned earlier that like the sequence in Luminary is Frank's two families kind of fighting over him. Here you have the same thing happening, because what happens with, you know, Peter and Frank here happens again with Frank and Catherine, almost structurally in the same place in Roosters. It's very early on in the episode. And again, that's structured very consciously to give you that sense of kind of broken mirroring within the two-parter, which is quite remarkable and quite impressive and very, very clever. But even then, you have this idea of, and again, it, like, even the same arguments take place. You have, you know, Peter saying, you know, oh, I'd never lie to you, Frank. And Frank saying, you didn't tell me this thing that was very important. That is lying. Which is exactly what Catherine says to Frank in the next episode. It's like, you didn't tell me this because you thought I couldn't handle it. That is tantamount to lying. And you have this idea that the same thing's happening throughout. That, like, this is a family breakdown. This is a family dispute. It doesn't matter that, you know, Peter and Frank aren't actually married or anything like that. They are friends. They are practically family to one another. And you have this kind of weird sense of kind of this divide that neither of them can kind of get across, and neither of them can kind of fully understand the other's perspective. Neither of them can really kind of make that connection that you talked about, that kind of tether that Frank and Catherine do still have to one another. But you have this sense of Peter and Frank being unable to kind of get across this. And it's so perfectly played. And you can, watching it, you can see why Terry O'Quinn was cast so well as John Locke in Lost, because he completely sells. He completely sells the idea that Peter believes this when he talks about the Freemasons, when he talks about the, you know, God on the $1 bill, when he talks about the history of America and, you know, sort of like the notion of all this being part of some grander design that makes sense if you know all the details. And Frank then also like making an equally valid amount of sense in saying, no, this is all nonsense. What are you talking about? This is absurd. Why would you believe this? I think he literally says, you're not, it's not enough, Peter. You're not giving me enough here. Which again gets this notion of faith, because for Peter, the fact that it's not enough isn't a problem, because he's able to fill those gaps with his faith. He's able to, exactly. He's able to connect the dots and make the pattern fit. And again, this is one of the things that the second season Millennium does so well. That ambiguity that I mentioned is important, because it means that, like, Peter actually has to fill those gaps. Whereas, say, the X-Files, where Mulder has faith, but that doesn't really matter because we know aliens exist, and it therefore isn't really, you know, kind of traditionally faith. It isn't kind of equivalent to faith if I go to church and pray and believe in God, despite the fact I have no proof of that. You know, Mulder's belief in aliens in the world of the X-Files, you know, while it works metaphorically as faith, it doesn't kind of map one-to-one. And even the same with Scully's religious belief, because we know from episodes like Revelation, from All Souls, from various other episodes like that, even if you want to go, you know, to the, you know, mythology episodes and go to Biogenesis and the Sixth Extinction and Mor Fati, we know that, like, God exists in the universe of the X-Files in a way that is, that makes sense or corresponds at least in some way to Scully's belief in a divine authority. So her faith isn't the same as the faith of somebody in, you know, the real world where you have to make those leaps, where those gaps do exist. And I really like that in the second season of Millennium, because of all that ambiguity that we mentioned, because we're not really sure to what extent the, you know, True Cross operates as a religious relic, or to what extent, you know, the Millennium Group are actually in control of the universe, or, you know, to what extent whether the owls or roosters are correct about the Millennium at this point in the show's run. Because of that, Peter's faith actually has substance to it, because we don't know if he's right. And we also don't know if he's wrong. And that's an incredible bit of kind of writing to pull off. And again, it's something that works well. And it works so well because O'Quinn sells it. O'Quinn sells the hell out of it. And Henriksen is just as good step for step with him as well. And it's great because you can see the two characters' arcs as well. Because you can see Frank being pushed gradually further and further along. Laura Mean's breakdown is much more literal. It's much more, again, the word hallucinations occurs. You know, the images of angels that she sees. But, like, watching owls and roosters, and owls in particular, because you have this, you know, throughout you have the sense of Frank being watched and Frank being paranoid, and building towards, you know, the cliffhanger of the episode where Frank goes out into the street with a gun. You have this sense of Frank becoming gradually unmoored, of him being pushed to a point where he's not even sure what he believes. Peter at least actually believes in something that he knows, you know, that he actually can verify, that he actually kind of like can measure and quantify and say, I believe that Freemasons secretly run the world, that the United States was established by, you know, these people who built secret plans into the dollar bill and thus control our fate and our destiny. Whereas Frank doesn't have that. And so, but he also doesn't have anything else he can anchor himself in, and so becomes more unhinged. And again, that I think it's a beautiful sequence. It's a wonderful contrast between two characters, between two actors, and kind of like the two of them kind of meshing together beautifully.
Yeah, and I think you get a clear delineation between how both of them work. And as you say, that the whole faith and the pragmaticness of, if even that's even a word, but the pragmatic Frank Black there, that he, you know, Frank is very methodical. And some of the things that you touched upon, which I want to delve into a little bit further, that we talk about this, the thing about him being within the family, and that he's, you know, that's what the show is about in a lot of ways, that this episode particularly pushes that fact that he's being pushed into a corner, that he's, and he can't get out, he can't escape this, this is coming. And some of the little nods that we get, I think the, just one comment while it's in my head, actually, there's one scene within that little talk where Frank says something, I can't remember exactly what he says to Peter, but Terry O'Quinn's reaction is absolutely priceless. And I just love his look of shock on his face, which is brilliant. But the way that Frank has been pushed into a corner, he is aware that, you know, at one point he sees his family, when he's seen his family off, the cars in on the road, and then we get the whole clear night thing, as you've mentioned, which we'll delve into in a second, that the Frank is getting this air of paranoia about him, that something is not right here, that, you know, when he's staring at Claire and the car's not working, that, you know, you're feeling from Frank that there's something, he's putting pieces together, he's realizing that these things aren't right, and this is what leads him to actually go and grab the gun. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on up until this point, because he's very much at this up until this point very much more of a like what Doctor Who would be. You know, the Doctor never held a gun. It's not that way. Season one, Chris Carter said that he wanted to have his hands down. He doesn't want to gesticulate, that he was very much a thinking man. But this is the point where he's led to this stage where he goes for the gun and confronts somebody.
And does his Travis Bickle impression as well. I don't see anybody else here. You must be looking for me. Again, like, this is a thing where having that first season, and again, I feel like, you know, when I praise the second season, I don't want it to seem like I'm disparaging the first season too much. I think the second half of the first season is absolutely incredible. I think the first half is fascinating and has some really great episodes in it as well. And I think that this sequence wouldn't have that weight or impact or effect if the first season hadn't established Frank as so level-headed and so balanced and so anchored and so kind of so certain in being so anchored, if that makes sense. Like, Frank takes great value in being kind of level-headed. And it's notable that, like, the way the episode is structured, it's not really like a mythology episode of The X-Files. Because a mythology episode of The X-Files typically has Mulder and Scully kind of running around solving something or investigating or pulling at a twine and getting quite close to, like, what's actually happening. Whereas Owls, in particular, now Roosters, to be fair, does bring Frank into the plot a great deal more. But Owls very much keeps Frank at a remove from all the stuff that the audience is seeing, from all the machinations happening within the group, from all that stuff that we're seeing involving kind of the True Cross being brought, you know, from Syria into the United States, over to Paraguay? Is that where it is?
Paraguay, yes.
Yeah. So, you know, on that journey that it has, Frank exists kind of completely removed from that. So there is this sense of kind of disconnect there as well, which is very, very effective, because it does make it seem like Frank is outside of, you know, the hero's role almost in this story. And again, that's uncanny, because so much of the second season is actually structured around Frank's hero's journey. You know, you have the very literal, like, you know, moment, midnight, you know, the midnight, long dark midnight of the soul in the Curse of Frank Black. You have the atonement with the father happening in a very literal sense in Midnight of the Century. But you have even kind of his arc across the season being structured in that kind of Campbellian way. I think, both Morgan and Wong have talked about that in the wonderful kind of Back to Frank Black, how they wanted that to be a huge part of what Frank's doing. So in Owls, the fact that Frank doesn't have that key role or that key function or that key place in the plot that's unfolding becomes unsettling of itself. And again, Mark Snow's score is fantastic, particularly in that sequence building towards the climax, where there is this, it's almost kind of this eerie choral kind of theremin sounding kind of sequence where things are gradually building and becoming kind of unsettling in a way that you can't quite put your finger on. And I think that having Frank go to that extreme, having him pull the gun, even though as somebody who has watched the show since the first season, even allowing for the end and the beginning, this is still something that feels like an escalation in what Frank's done. It makes sense because it actually has weight and impact, because you feel the sense of Frank feeling kind of left out and Frank kind of being cast aside. And again, season has been building to this. You mentioned Luminary, where, you know, Frank basically wanders off into the wilderness, nominally to find a kid who's lost, but arguably just as much to find himself as well. And you have this sense of Frank trying to figure out where he belongs and where he fits in. And again, I think that, you know, you mentioned the idea of Frank and kind of Catherine's reconciliation, this two-parter. And I think it's very clear that they both want it to happen. And I think that Frank thinks it's perhaps closer than it is. I think that Frank maybe kind of needs it to be closer than it is. I think that, you know, of the two going through this separation, Catherine's very frank. She's not, you know, she's not dealing with it particularly well. In Luminary, she's kind of like, she consults the tarot to try and figure out what's going on. Like, she's so lost, you know, she's so struggling to make sense of it that she actually turns to astrology and kind of mysticism to try and offer an explanation for what's happened. But she kind of pulls herself back from that. And there's a sense that maybe she's dealing with it in a kind of healthier way, this separation. Whereas Frank sublimates that sense of loss of his family into the group and invests so much in the group so that when that snaps, and again, this is the thing where the serialized storytelling in the second season works so well, because again, you've had this building across the season. You've had Frank becoming more and more impatient with Peter and more frustrated with the way in which the group keeps secrets from him, that when that boils over with Peter in that conversation, it feels entirely in keeping that Frank is much, much, much more on edge, because not only, you know, is he still separated from Catherine and Jordan, his real family, he's also now pushed himself away from, and again, entirely healthy and entirely reasonable, but you don't think like that when you're in that situation. You don't think, gee, it's great that I have these really toxic people out of my life. You think, no, I'm alone now. I'm really, really, really alone, really isolated. I have no support mechanism whatsoever. And I'm just sitting there, stewing in my thoughts, Googling Adolf Hitler. And kind of like...
Which, by the way, is my favourite, one of my favourite parts of the show, because the amount of force he puts into that mouse click is absolutely incredible.
I mean, we've all been there, Kurt, right? Yeah. You're all just idly Googling Hitler, and you're like, do I want to see the next one? Do I really want to read the next... And particularly, like, in the thank you for the sound effects there. But yeah, okay. Particularly in the context of the late 90s as well, because I remember that was a big thing online where it's like, you have access to absolutely everything now. Everything is on the internet in the late 90s, apart from Aerotech South America. But everything else is available online. And kind of like that sense of when you were reading about stuff. And again, maybe this is just me. Maybe I'm revealing far too much about my personal life on this show. But when you're Googling stuff that you read about in school, but obviously stuff that was sanitized. So, for example, doing research on the Second World War, and in particular, some of the stuff that the Nazis did during the Second World War, where you would hear about the Holocaust and you would read about the Holocaust. But then when you Google it and it's all available online and it's like, this is all stuff that absolutely really happened. And if we're being frank, probably should be more widely talked about and more widely sort of discussed. But it's all out there. But like for somebody who kind of had an education that was based on kind of history books and school conversations, in the late 90s, I remember Googling things like that and being like, do I really want to read this? Do I really want to click on this link? Do I really want to know what that experience was like for somebody in that situation? Do I want to read survivor testimony? Do I want to read A Nuremberg Disposition? Do I want that stuff bouncing around inside my head? And that's actually what I think about when I kind of see Frank kind of cycling through that stuff. Because, you know, yes, it Nazi stuff is obviously dark anyway, but in the context of the 90s, when, you know, people had just discovered the internet and all that information was just out there really for the first time for anybody to stumble across, I remember feeling that similar sense of trepidation. Now, to be fair, Frank is, you know, what, in his late 40s, 50s, I was at the time probably, what, 12? But I empathize with that a great deal, I think. And I kind of see, I get that sense of, and again, it's that sense that's very similar to what I talked about with Laura, which is, you know, is Laura just like struggling to process the information that's coming at her and therefore kind of like finding a way to structure it in a way that makes sense because there's so much information coming at us through forums like the internet? Is she just finding a way to impose her own structure on that? And then is Frank doing the same thing just in a much more literal sense where it's like, well, I Googled Nazis, therefore everything that I'm seeing now points to a secret Nazi conspiracy because there's so much information out there that I can just fit it together and kind of fit it into my worldview. And I kind of, yeah, I think that kind of fits with the general mood of the episode and the general tone of where Frank is, which is, he's at a low ebb. He's vulnerable in a kind of a psychological sense. And he's also Googling the death of Adolf Hitler. It's not a good place to be. And again, it's one of those things that Millennium does so well where it works, I would argue, primarily based on mood and theme and tone as much as logic. But it's really atmospheric and it's really effective. And again, yeah, so I entirely by that sequence with Frank with the gun, and I find it unsettling, and I think the episode knows that and intends it to be.
I think what Schindler's List was 93. Was Schindler's List 93?
Yeah.
So you're talking 5 years out from Schindler's List, and I obviously I'm slightly older, so I'd have been 18 when Millennium was out, and 13 when Schindler's List came out, and I do remember actually looking up the Nuremberg trials. Later than that, I think it would have been when YouTube first started rearing its head. I think that must have been 2005, 2006. But it was in the psyche, and I don't think I would have searched for the Nuremberg trials or anything like that at that point. But you know, I actually visually remember going online and reading stuff and seeing pictures and things like that. So similar to you, it's a curiosity which, you know, when you actually, you know, when, as I say, I did history as when I was at school, and you know, and as you say, the sanitization of it is right, really, and I wouldn't have thought that in this terms here, but yeah, it's certainly something to think about with regards to that scene, which moves us onto the actual water painting and Clear Night, What are your thoughts on our good friend Cleo Knight? What do you make of the character? Put it that way.
Well, Cleo Knight is notable for being played by Kimberly Patton, who is the stage name of Aisling Gear, who's actually a regular of Morgan and Wong. She appeared in Blood in the second season of The X-Files, and she had a recurring role as, I think, Felicity O on Space Above and Beyond. And again, this is one of the things where I don't know if you want to leave too much of the talking of Odessa about Odessa to the next episode to talk about Roosters, but in terms of just very broadly, in terms of the character of Cleo Knight and the function of kind of Airtech, it's one of those things where, you know, not only are owls and roosters, obviously, we mentioned mirroring, you know, a mythology episode in The X-Files, where you have stuff like Patient X and The Red and the Black obviously airing at the same time. They also very clearly mirror the mythology episodes in the first season, Millennium, in particular, Lamentation and Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions. And what's notable is that although it's never explicitly stated, I think it's strong, and I think the implication is strong enough, and I think that the trope is familiar enough that people pick up on it anyway. But what is actually happening with Cleo Knight and with Catherine and with Frank is very much an extension of what you get with Alistair Pepper in Powers, Principalities, Thrones, and Dominions, which is this idea of a deal with the devil. And again, it's something that has happened, like, you know, the second season of Millennium has offered its own variation on that in, obviously, The Curse of Frank Black, where you have the wonderful Dean Winters showing up, you know, as the ghost of Mr. Kersal, and saying, look, Frank, just down there, all they want you to do is sit out this battle that's happening. Just take a break, take a breather, take some time off, sit on the bench, go to your family, be with the people you love. And even before it's revealed exactly what Aerotech is, although, let's be frank, we are an organization from South America in an episode about Nazis. What could we possibly be? But yes, even before it's revealed what Aerotech actually is, Cleo Knight is kind of portrayed as this mysterious character, this kind of ominous character, and particularly ominous because she's always smiling and she's so polite and she's so caring and she loves so much and is so accommodating. And just wants you to know that you're part of the family, Kurt. Do you know that you're part of the family? Because you are.
Well, I think you should come over and have a family get-together, Darren. When this is all over, when we've had the epidemic that's left, and come over and have some special time with me.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
That's exactly it. Is that, like, that's what Cleo Knight and Aerotech represent. Because they are kind of entrapping Catherine. They're luring Catherine in. And it's like, Joe, it's an easy job. The money will be good. It's literally everything that you could ever want. You only have to do maybe a couple of nights a week. It'll be de-stressful. It won't at all be draining in any way, shape, or form. There'll be lots of money. Make yourself comfortable. Kind of do it. And through that, hoping that they can maybe lure Frank back. And indeed, you have that sequence where Cleo Knight is like, yeah, you two should have a double date with me and my husband. Where it's very much kind of a sense that what they want to do is they want to get the Black family back together. They want Frank to come back home to Catherine. They want Frank to kind of, like, to know that he is safe. I'm fairly sure that, like, eventually they would have offered Frank some sort of nice, cushy consultancy job working for them, where he never would have had to do anything unpleasant whatsoever. He just would have had to be on staff and, you know, maybe consult on some product launches or something like that. Again, there's that sense of them being that kind of metaphorical deal with the devil. The idea of, well, look, what if you separate yourself from this cause to which you've engaged? What if you, you know, again, this sense of, like, the 90s and kind of affluence, the sense of what if you abandon any sense of social responsibility that you have and you just accept large piles of money to do absolutely nothing? Wouldn't that be great? And a sense of kind of give up, lay down your burdens. And again, it's a very kind of, you know, religious kind of metaphorical kind of concept. But it works clear enough that you can kind of see it. You can kind of see it there, that there is a sense of maybe this is the deal that Purcell was talking about. Maybe Cleo Knight, with this kind of weirdly vague, you know, Boeing contract manufacturing company, are offering kind of Frank and Catherine a chance to kind of check out, cash in their chips, say, we've done our bit, we've had our struggles, We've suffered as much as we want to suffer. We just want to sit in the sidelines and we want to be comfortable. And it's kind of, I think that it works very well in that sense, because even though the deal is never articulated in those terms, even though Clear Knight never has a scene with Frank or a scene with Catherine where she spells out exactly what the deal is in the same way that Purcell does or in the same way that Pepper does, it's very clear that, like, that's the inference there. Like, literally all Frank has to do is, like, not notice the painting. He has to miss the painting. That's all that's required from him. And again, like, you have this sense of them, like, it's very clear that Aerotech are trying to bring Frank and Catherine together, because it's very clear that they sabotaged Catherine's car, but not for any sinister purpose. It's like some weird Nazi date night. It's like, it's like a Nazi rom-com. It's like, you can imagine Clear Knight sitting in a business meeting, sitting down going, yeah, but what we need to do is we need to sabotage her car so she has to call Frank, right? And then they realize how much they always loved each other. It's like, you reckon that if, like, Aerotech had remained a part of kind of this larger franchise or this larger sort of, like, mythology going forward, that they would have got to the stage where, like, they managed to trick Catherine and Frank into getting stuck in a lift together. And they'd be like, this'll do it. This'll be the one that'll get them back together. And I kind of like the kind of low stakes aspect of it. I kind of admire the idea that you have this plot to take over the world in which Aerotech is obviously, you know, a minor player maybe, but a significant player nonetheless. And their primary objective seems to be playing matchmaker to Frank and Catherine. And again, that's that sense of, like, everything in the show spiraling outwards from that divorce. Everything in the show making sense in the context of that divorce. Even shady Nazi companies from South America building jumbo jets for Boeing still manage to exist in the context of this, you know, separation between Frank and Catherine. And I like that. I kind of love how weird that is. Because it absolutely and uncompromisingly and unapologetically weird. Like, I again love the X-Files, but I absolutely could not imagine an episode of the X-Files where the cigarette smoking man. I suppose actually, now that you mention it, another Morgan episode, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man. But where the cigarette smoking man effectively decides that his big master plan is going to be getting Mulder and Scully together. Like, romantically. That's the whole end game here. It's not colonization. It's making Mulder and Scully happy. It would be like the well-manicured man when he's like, enough of your planning about, you know, eliminating them. Why? Finally, a problem you can't solve with bullets. One you can solve with roses. And then, the well-manicured man offers an elaborate pitch where he will convince Mulder and Scully to fall in love with one another and therefore stop investigating the conspiracy. And they can continue going on what they're doing, which is an episode of The X-Files that I now kind of want to see, given that
you're talking about that, and I'm thinking Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man. Generally, I'm only talking in general terms because I'm aware people do like it. Is not an episode that some people love and other people absolutely hate it. But I think if you had Musings altered to the point where Cigarette Smoking Man is designing to get Mulder and Scully together, I think that the shippers would absolutely adore that episode.
And make it clear that the reason why he's doing it isn't because he's like wants Mulder to be happy. It's just his latest plan to, like, get Mulder out of his own hair. It's like, fine, I tried to kill him a couple of times, it didn't work. I tried to close the X-Files and it didn't work. Finally, this is the clincher. This is going to be the one that does it.
Cigarette Smoking Man is the ultimate shipper. That is going on Twitter when this episode airs. We'll have ratings will go through the roof, Darren, for this episode. And it won't be what we've been talking about for the last hour. Yeah.
It's not even next X-Files episode.
Oh, amazing. Oh, right. That is incredible. I absolutely love that idea of Cigarette Smoking Man doing that. But anyway, I think we may be getting to the end of our particular episode anyway, after that revelation. And why didn't Morgan and Wong go down that route? I don't know. So I think the only things that we haven't really touched upon, now bearing in mind we are going through two episodes, is the old man comes back into the show at this point. He's been referred to in Beware of the Dog and a couple of other things where, Lara's been to see him and he comes into here. And I think the only other aspect, which we touched upon briefly, and I think the using of the car thing with the electrical magnetic pulse thing, That gets brought up in the scene where the horse with no name, which after watching this episode back in 1998, became my favourite song for a long time, actually. It was a song I hadn't really heard that much before this episode, and after that episode, you know, I would find it in jukeboxes in clubs and stuff and be like, yeah, pubs, and I'm putting that on. You've got that, and you've also got the scene at the beginning where the crucifixion cross is taken from the airport. So that kind of interweaves the story in some elements. So is there anything else you want to talk about particularly about that car scene and the that whole thing of the Millennium Group member, Mr. Johnston?
Well, I mean, just the way in which that's very clearly an extension or kind of escalation of the way in which Morgan and Wong have been telling stories. I mean, one of the things that defines their work on The X-Files, and I'm thinking particularly of episodes like Home, for example, but it's also there in, say, Never Again. But it's this idea of kind of the use of music in a way that you didn't see a lot of in 90s television, but which you see a lot more in the prestige television era, which is this idea of kind of the ironic juxtaposition of the song that you're listening to, which is cheerful and upbeat, but also then having it play diegetically kind of within the scene. It's something that is very kind of cinematic. It's something that you associate with films, and you can see horror films doing it quite a bit as well, but it's something that I wasn't really used to seeing on network television at the time. And again, the way in which that scene plays out, where it unfolds over so much time in the episode, I think it takes up a solid 5-6 minutes for the death of a character who is minor. You know, he's played by one of those great recurring Vancouver actors who had a role in, you know, each of the first 3 seasons of The X-Files, for example, because he, you know, he's never really been that big a player. We can just keep recycling him and using him in that way. But he gets a whole kind of 6-minute death sequence here, which relies on kind of the use of a horse with no name, which again is something that I wouldn't have seen a lot of in television. It's that kind of like, as in narrative terms, the death of Johnston is something that you could do very, very quickly. You could do it in almost 30 seconds. But giving it that much space in the episode is weird and unusual and ambitious, and kind of speaks the way in which everything's done atmospherically. And again, Wright's direction is really fantastic. The lighting, the sequence where Johnston is lit by the car that's pulled up behind him, for example, as he's kind of bending down and trying to fix it, the kind of the red lights from the hazard lights that are kind of visible at various points in the scene as well, and even kind of the way in which the song keeps playing after the car blows up as well. It's just, again, it's this wonderfully moody, weird piece of television, which is something that I imagine you would have a very hard time justifying if you were writing, you know, if you were in a writer's room in a 90s network TV show, but which Morgan and Wong commit to without any hesitation. It's brilliant. I absolutely adore it.
And I think it works well. I mean, we'll talk about this when we get to the end of the season with the song that's in the end of The Time Is Now as well. I think that works quite well with having the two in there, because it prepares you for that. It definitely prepared that for me anyway.
It's a building point. Again, like, it's very clear, like, you can see watching Owls and Roosters and then watching the finale, you can see that, like, Owls and Roosters exists halfway between what we recognize as television and, you know, the Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now. It's very much like a staging ground. There's a weird kind of sense of, how much can we get away with? We got away with all of it? Well, now, let's roll up the sleeves and do it properly. And it's amazing, again, to see that happen within a single season of television, because normally shows take 2 or 3 seasons to nail down what they're doing. I mean, again, even The X-Files, where I know a lot of people love the second season of The X-Files, but for me, you know, when it reaches the third season, it's almost a soft reboot, because we're going to take all the lessons we learned over those 2 years and start doing it right. So to watch the second season of Millennium and have them go from, are we doing this in Owls and Roosters, to we're doing this in The Fourth Horseman and The Time Is Now is kind of staggering in terms of just confidence. Again, amazing season of television.
I think that's probably a good place to finish up for this episode. As I mentioned briefly, the old man does appear in this episode, but we do have quite a substantial piece of next episode with him in, so we'll talk about him next week. I'll leave that on a cliffhanger for you. We also have taken some questions on the Facebook group as well, but again, because of the two-part aspects of it, we'll take them in next week's episode as well. Is anything finally, Darren, you want to bring up with regards to this episode before we call it a night?
No, I think that's really about it. Aside from maybe noting that, you know, the owl is a kind of a very famous conspiratorial symbol appearing in places as interesting as Bohemian Grove. There's a whole bunch of weird owl kind of eschatology kind of stuff going on out there. If you want to Google it and go down a rabbit hole, you can click your mouse very definitely and very slowly as you read those articles if you want for maximum kind of atmospheric impact.
I absolutely will be doing that. So... As always, Darren, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Be with us next week to talk about Roosters. Where can people find you online? What are you up to at the moment? And where can people find you online?
Yep, so you can find me online at Twitter. I'm at Darren_Mooney, where I'm tweeting online, possibly about movies, although I don't know if they're still making those, and also about TV shows, and just about general pop culture in general. You can follow me, I'm at the Movie Blog with a 0 instead of an O as well, where I've reviewed every episode of Millennium. So if you want to read or a deep dive on any of the show, you can get that there as well. I also co-host a podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew Quinn. And as you're listening to this, actually, if you're listening as a Patreon, tomorrow we will be releasing our podcast covering The Wages of Fear with the wonderful Tony Black. I don't know if you met him, Kurt. He's a lovely fellow.
I've heard he's a nice fellow, yeah.
And
he's not—he's quite smiley as well. He does give an unerringness of, like, you know, come and join us kind of thing. So, well, yeah, but he's quite a nice lad.
He does only want the people that he wants, Kurt.
That's very true.
I love how dark that got when you're like, yes, that is actually depressingly accurate. Sorry, Tony. That's okay.
Yeah, sorry, mate. Sorry.
Is your supervisor a literal Nazi, Kurt?
Well, I won't. I can't say these things on air.
That's a fair point.
we'll leave it at that.
If you are not a patron, if you're listening to this as it appears in the feed for regular listeners, Tony will also have joined us the previous Saturday to discuss Wade Sorcerer, which he's doing as part of his New Wave podcast project. So we're kind of thrilled to get kind of a sneak peek, get invited on, and kind of work through the format with him on that. And we're actually releasing the episode a little bit early. So if you want a sneak peek of a new We Made This podcast episode, you can find that on the 250 feed and a nice bit of symmetry.
You can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. Obviously, you've been speaking to me regarding The Time Is Now, but you can also find the Pick Up A podcast, which we've been doing early in the year. And you'll find me all over the We Made This podcast network at the moment. I'm on quite a few bits and bobs here and there. We're going to be giving you just a brief glimpse into what we have had on the network as well, the We Made This podcast network, straight after this show. So stick around for that. But until next time, everyone, remember... Roosters crow at the dawn, hoping to arouse the barnyard, but the owl knows it is still late at night. The foxes are about, the master sleeps. This is who we are.
Previously on the We Made This Network. The giddy carousel of pop.
Carol Decker from T'Pau, who were actually at number one with China in Your Hand when this issue of Smash Hits was Indian news agents.
Carol's really up for it. She knows what the kids want. They want stories about being sick in a cowboy boot, so they get that. I've fallen asleep with my head down a toilet many a time, and Ronnie, who's out of the band, her boyfriend, has helped me throw up into a bucket.
She's a short-tempered bitch, according to what it says here in the article.
Didn't she throw some stuff at him?
Yes.
Life's milestones.
So let's move on and talk about birth. When and where and how were you born?
Through the vagina, I believe.
Oh. I've literally just said what a great man you are, and you're really crude. You are a very literal person.
I was born at the outset of the National Health Service in 1947.
Free with this month's issue.
When we supported them, we brought loads of, like, family and friends and people. My parents and my sister came, and as everybody was walking along the drive to get up there, their tour bus was there, and their guitarist was standing in the doorway beckoning at lots of underage girls while wearing a t-shirt that said drugs, unsuccessfully, and I think in a joking way that he was sort of beckoning. Okay. But
would have got me.
Yeah, my mum was not very impressed. Neither was my girlfriend at the time, Kelly, because I wouldn't let her go on the fucking tour.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.
Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, was created by Tony Black and is produced by Tony Black and Kurt North. We can be found on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod or by searching Facebook for The Time Is Now. We are part of the We Made This Podcast Network, which can be found on Twitter at We Made This Pod or on the website WeMadeThisPod.com. For bonus material and exclusives, check out our sister show, The X-Cast, and X-Files Podcast, where you can find our Patreon. This is who we are.